We're going to look at the first 14 verses to talk about perseverance in difficult days. And, of course, if you're paying attention to what we've been singing, our songs are moving in this direction. The choir saying, be strong in the Lord, something God calls us to do in this passage. Hiding in thee, may the Lord find us faithful. Talking about hiding in God and persevering to the end. And a special by Bruce and Caleb, I lift my eyes unto the hill, something that we do through the power of God. And something this passage calls us to do. Perseverance in days of difficulty. Look at verse 1 with me, if you would. Jesus left the temple and was going away when his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. But he answered them, you see all these, do you not? Truly I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. As he sat on Mount Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming at the close of the age? And Jesus answered them, see that no one leads you astray. For many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and they will lead many astray. And you will hear of wars and rumors of war. See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are but the beginnings of the birth pains. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. And because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. We come across an extremely difficult and complex chapter to interpret. I'm sure you understand that. When you look at Matthew 24, there are not just a few interpretations. There are literally dozens of interpretations. And good men are going to disagree on various eschatological points in their interpretation of chapter 24 and 25. As a premillennialist, I'm going to understand some events here a little bit different than an amill or a postmill friend. And as I was reading through this chapter, it just reminded me that good men disagree on some of the events in Matthew 24. And we should hold our view with great humility. Hold it for sure, but hold it with humility. And as I was reading through the events, it reminded me once again that where people tend to focus on prophecy, Jesus is far less concerned about giving us a timeline than he is about how we respond to events that come into our lives. You and I tend to be obsessed with the prophecy. Jesus is much more concerned about the practical. He's concerned about how we respond to trial and tribulations that come our way. And so Jesus isn't so much here trying to give a timeline as he's calling us to be faithful in times of tribulation. All prophecy, you can read any prophecy in the New Testament, anywhere it talks about something that's going to happen in the last days, there's always an exhortation to persevere in times of difficulty. We read the book of Revelation and we get excited about some of the events in Revelation, but the book of Revelation is not Jesus trying to give us a timeline or a map to the end of the world. Of course, that's to call us to persevere till the end. He's showing us that he's in control of all the events. And all that unfolds is at the power of his hands. But we are to be, in the book of Revelation, uses the word overcomers. And so it is here in Matthew 24 and 25. You and I get very concerned. We're kind of like the disciples. In Acts, the disciples said, Lord, when will the end of the age be? And he says, you know, only the Father knows that, but you need to persevere till the end. I want you to show you real quick in Matthew 24 and 25 that it's good to be concerned with prophecy, but the real lesson here is that we continue in the gospel and we stay faithful to God all the way till the end. Let me show you a couple of passages. Matthew, here in chapter 4, verse 5 through 12, we read. Now, verse 13, here's the practical. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. Verse 15 all the way through verse 42. But look at verse 42. Here's the application. Therefore, he says, after the abomination of desolation, verse 42, stay awake, for you do not know on the day when your Lord is coming. Now, look at the verse 43 again. But know this, that the master of the house, had he known what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have what? Stayed awake and would have not let his house be broken into. Therefore, you must also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour that you do not expect. Jesus unfolds some events at the end times, and then he says, the most important thing here is not that you stick all this together on a timeline. The most important thing is you are faithful to the end. Prophecy is always a call for us to be faithful and to trust God. As we move into chapter 25, we have this famous parable of the 10 virgins. Well, all that culminates in verse 13. Therefore, what? Watch, for you know neither the day nor the hour. We have the parable of the talents, and that ends with verse 29 of chapter 5. For to everyone who has been given, there will be an abundance, but to the one who has not, even he will be taken away. And again, the final judgment in chapter 25, 31 through 46, that ends with a word of perseverance. Every sign, every symbol is a reminder that we're called to persevere to the end. And Jesus here is concerned about things that his followers are less concerned about, but should be concerned about. The disciples, verse 3, want to know when. They say, when will these things be? And what will the sign of your coming at the close of the age? Jesus here answers that question, but then he gets down to the most important thing. The most important thing is not that you know every single event. The most important thing is that you know that I know every single event. There are times when my kids are in the back seat and they'll say things like, Dad, where are we going? Dad, where are we going? And I'll explain where we're going, but I don't give every detail. And then I have to turn around and say, it's not important that you know where we're going. It's important that you know that I know where we're going. And that's what Jesus is calling us to do in this passage. When I was a kid, my brother and sister, we had our favorite babysitters, and mom and dad would call them to watch us while they went out for a night together. And as a young kid will do, we ask just a plethora of questions. Mom, where are you going? What time will you be back? When will we be in bed when you return? Are you going to bring us something back from the restaurant? All those really important questions that kids ask. And, you know, my dad and mom would often answer a few questions. Then they would say this. They'd say, don't worry about all that. You worry about being faithful and obeying the babysitter, you know. Knowing all the details is really not that important. The most important thing, he would say, is I'm coming back, and you want to make sure you're faithful while I'm gone. And to a great degree, that's what Jesus does with prophecy. He does it here. He does it in the book of Revelation. The call here is to persevere in difficult days. Now, let me kind of set the stage for the verses we're looking at this morning. If you understand this, the events will fall together. Jesus is assuming here that people fall away because of unreasonable expectations. One of the main reasons people fall away from the faith is they believe that when they become Christians, everything in their life is going to go well. But when difficulty comes in, they start to question the plan of God. Every Christian, every follower of Jesus Christ defaults to this. If Jesus is the king, why are things so bad in my life, or potentially bad? If you want to put it in Jewish terms, it looks like this. If Jesus has inaugurated the kingdom, why is there still evil in the world? And even when you know better, this is the default of the human heart. We often question the plan of God because our expectations are just different than the Lord's. And we've dealt with this from many different angles over the last several years. You know, Jeremiah struggles with this in Lamentations. If Jerusalem is the city of the king, how could God possibly allow it to be sacked? Unreasonable expectations. Peter fell away for a season because of this. If Jesus is the Christ, how could God allow him to die on a cross? The Philippians struggle with this. If Paul is our chief church planter, why would God allow him to be put in prison? That doesn't make any sense. In the book of Habakkuk, if God is the king of the universe, why is there lawlessness in the streets? We have an expectation that often differs from God. We believe that when we become Christians, everything's going to be okay in our lives. And Jesus shows us in Matthew 24, here in the last days, it's not going to look like that. That's not how things go down. Every Christian struggles with this. If Jesus is the king,
and I am faithfully serving him, why is there so much pain and so much stress in my life? Matthew 24, in part, is about having a reasonable expectation until he returns. And Jesus, in the verses I read here, the first 14 verses, he shows us what the end days are going to look like. And they're not going to look like days that we might want them to look like. They're going to look a little bit different. There's war and rumor of war. There's people falling away. There's many false prophets that are going to arise. Lawlessness, verse 13, is going to be increased. The love of many is going to grow cold. And right up until the coming of Christ, this is going to characterize the world.
Now, let me say this before we talk about some of the specifics. The reason we need to have reasonable expectations about what's going to take place in the last days, it's going to guard against two things. Number one, it guards against discouragement. Reasonable expectations, as Jesus points out here, are essential to be successful in any venture. Some of you have studied the Napoleonic Wars. And you know that prior to the Battle of Waterloo, the Duke of Wellington gave his generals and captains a command. He called his generals together and he said, "Now here's the plan. We have an international army, many of whom have never fought one with another. We're going up against the greatest offensive leader in the history of warfare, Napoleon. His army is made up of much greater men than ours. We're outnumbered. Therefore, here's the plan. We're going to let him pound away on us all day long. And the only goal is to hold together until the Prince of Bismarck comes with his army. And then in the end, we're going to win." Quite a plan, isn't it? You know, it worked. Wellington told his forces that it's not going to look pretty for the beginning and most of this battle. And only then in the end, when the Prince of Bismarck comes, will he come and bring that aid and the rescue that we need. Now, what if Wellington did not tell his generals about this plan? They'd grow discouraged in the battle. They'd feel like they were losing and there was no plan. But he prepared them for the expectation all day and all night. There's going to be difficulty in our lives, but hang in there. As bad as it looks, in the end, the Prince of Bismarck will come with his army, and in the end, we're going to win. And that's exactly what happened. Jesus looks at his disciples and says this: it's going to look bad. It's going to look grim. War, rumor of war, people are going to fall away, lawlessness in the streets, all this bad stuff is going to hang on. But get verse 13, the one who endures to the end, he's going to be saved. Because the day is coming when I will show up in the battle and I will stamp out all the evil in the world. Jesus gives a reasonable expectation to his disciples. It's not going to be all pretty. It's not going to be like Christians go out in the world and everybody's going to welcome us with open arms. It's not like every job you apply for you're going to get. Not every diet's going to work. Not everybody's going to befriend you. Not everybody you ask on a date is going to say yes, right? In the last days, things are going to be very difficult on Christians, all the way to persecution by death. Jesus says, hang in there. I have a plan. When I come, we're going to win. It is essential that we understand these instructions or we're going to grow discouraged in the battle. Now, let me say this. No doubt there's going to be some great spiritual victories in this age. I know that because of verse 14. The gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. So we're not saying that it's all misery and it's all bad and there's no common grace and the gospel's not going to go forward. But Jesus does prepare us to be reasonable in our expectations. Not only will we grow discouraged if we're unreasonable in our expectations, we're going to grow disillusioned in the battle. We're going to doubt that God is really in control, and Jesus doesn't want that to happen. Unreasonable expectations lead you to believe that God has allowed the universe to spin out of control. But everything Jesus says here will come to pass, and when it does, we know everything is going according to plan. I think about Israel in the wilderness. And this disillusionment actually happened to them. You think about how excited they were about the Exodus. I mean, God parts the sea, swallows the Egyptian army. Prophecy is beginning to be fulfilled. The expectations are high. God is leading them to a land flowing with milk and honey. All along the way, God is planning to feed them with manna. The problem is although everything is going according to God's plan, their expectations are out of step with God's. And they soon begin to complain. They soon begin to murmur about not having all the benefits of the land right there at that moment. And they grow not only discouraged, but disillusioned with the promises of God. And they begin to say things like, you know, back in Egypt we had melons and garlic, and I don't know where you find that back in Egypt, but apparently they did. They grew discouraged and they grew disillusioned. Why? Their expectations are out of step with God. Jesus here does not want the church's expectations to be out of step with God. The plan is first cross, then resurrection. Remember? Jesus died on a cross, then he's raised from the dead. And some of us want all resurrection power now. We want all glory, all the benefits of the kingdom without enduring any suffering in this life. Jesus wants our expectation to be in step with his. Don't get disillusioned. Think about Abraham back in the book of Genesis. God promises Abraham that he and Sarah are going to have a child, one who would carry the promise of the covenant. Wonderful promise that God is going to do something great. But their expectation, time-wise, was out of step with God's. They expected that this child would come either right away or at least before they were 100 years old, you know? This waiting time became a temptation for them. They became disillusioned with the promise of God, and Abraham sins with Hagar. Unrealistic expectations lead to disillusionment. Matthew 24 is about God bringing our expectations in line with his plan so we avoid discouragement, avoid disillusionment, and we have the ultimate hope in our hearts of what the text eventually says here, so will the coming of the Son of Man. That right up until that day, the days are going to be difficult. But when Jesus comes back, he's going to stamp out all evil in this world. Winston Churchill could, of course, give a speech like no other. And just prior to Germany's attack against the British, he said, "I promise you only blood, sweat, toil, and tears." And Winston Churchill thoroughly believed that they were going to win in the end. But he said, let's not get our expectations out of step. Let's realize that right up until that final victory, we're going to have to fight, we're going to have to labor, and we're going to have to toil. Christ is guarding our hearts against disillusionment. Yes, Jesus will win. Yes, he will conquer. Yes, Christians will be vindicated and live with him forever. But until then, the last days will be characterized by evil and apostasy. All right, what specifically does Jesus have in mind? What are some things that will tempt us to fall away or things that may lead to discouragement and disillusionment if we're not careful? I'll give you five or six as time allows, okay? Number one, he warns us there's going to be an overwhelming display of false religion. Not just false religion, but an overwhelming display. Look at verse 4. And Jesus answered, "See that no one leads you astray. For many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and they will lead many astray." Now, I want you to notice a couple of things about false teaching here. Number one, false teaching is up front, and it's very intentional. Look at that little phrase, "lead you astray." You know what's implied here? What's implied here is that false religion isn't just, it's not just an accident that false religion is here. They're actually trying to lead people astray. False religion is intentional, it's volitional, it has an agenda, it wants to lead genuine believers into darkness. Galatians 1:7 backs this up. Paul says there is a gospel, not another. He says, but there are some who trouble you, get this language, and want to distort the gospel of Christ. You hear language? There are some that trouble you and want to distort the gospel of Christ. That word want is a Greek word thelo. It means wish, desire, want. It's got volition all over it. No accident here. Like Satan in the Garden of Eden that doesn't necessarily want to create a new truth, but distort or twist the original truth. Like a work of art, the word distort means. A person that draws a portrait and someone comes along and begins to add and subtract things from it. They distort the original. I'm not accusing every follower of a false religion of being this intentional. But as for the leadership, according to these verses, it's intentional and it's calculated and it's precise. In false religion, in our day and age, that's characterized by false religion, it's going to be overwhelming. Many will come. How many is many? I don't know, but it sounds like a lot, doesn't it?
Sounds like there's going to be a lot of temptation for us to follow false religion. And we hear names like Jim Jones, David Koresh, the Pope, Joseph Smith, all forms of secularism and humanism. Overwhelming display. Look down at the text with me. I want to give you two thoughts here off the word many. Once again, verse 5, many will come in my name, and then again, many will be led astray. I want you to notice that Satan here wants to confuse people two ways. Two ways here with false religion. Number one, Satan wants to confuse you by the sheer number of voices out there. The sheer number of voices. Many will come in my name. The sheer number of religious voices out there makes you want to throw your hands up and quit. I mean, it looks something like this. You start to try to seek out the truth. You start to study world religion. You're trying to discover what the truth really is. And you start to realize that every culture, every voice, even every subculture has their own idea of what the truth is. And you get so overwhelmed with so many voices out there, you finally throw your hands up and say, there's no way I can ever possibly know what the truth is anyway. The second way is not only the sheer number of voices out there, but the sheer number of followers all those voices have. The text says not only that many voices will be out there, but many will be led astray. And so Christ is warning us, don't follow the many. Don't follow the many voices, and don't follow the many masses. Again, I don't know how many is, but it seems to be a lot. And again, the narrative goes like this. How can the masses all be wrong? The masses follow false religion, and they tempt us to say, how can that be wrong if so many other people think it's right? I mean, the majority has to be right, right? Jesus says no. No, not at all. I love the speech that Senator James A. Reed of Missouri in 1926 delivered on a Senate floor. It's a famous speech, and it's titled Majority Rule. And in the speech, he cautions against the idea that the majority is always or even usually right. And James A. Reed says, the majority has been wrong oftener than it has been right in the course of time. The majority crucified Jesus Christ. The majority burned Christians at the stake. The majority drove Jews into exile in the ghetto. The majority established slavery. The majority chained to stakes and surrounded with circles of flames the martyrs through the ages of world history. The majority grinned and jeered when Columbus said the world was round. The majority threw him into a dungeon for having discovered a new world. The majority said that Galileo must recant or that Galileo must go to prison. The majority cut off the ears of John Pym because he dared advocate liberty of the press. The majority must be right, right? Not so. Jesus says many voices are out there and many people will follow those voices. Do not let that lead you astray. Let me give you one final thought that we'll probably circle back to at a later date. What this text implies is that in difficult days, people tend to turn to easy fixes. In a time of crisis, people are going to follow the first voice that comes their way. You start to suffer, a moment of pain comes into your life, you second guess all that God has taught you, and that's why it's essential. Seek after the truth of God, not when the hurricane is on us, but seek after God, right? All the time. So our roots are deep in the gospel, and we're ready and prepared for when persecution hits us. I think of it this way. The best time for a tree to grow roots is not during hurricane season. It's before hurricane season. And the best time for a Christian to develop the doctrine of the gospel and to begin to develop what we know about the Word of God and apply it is not when the hurricane and the difficult days are upon us, but we need to do that all the time so our roots are growing deep. Number one, there's going to be a lot of false religion. How about international chaos, verse 6? You're going to hear of wars and rumors of war. See that you're not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There'll be famines and earthquakes in various places. Look at the international chaos. Now, let me tell you what this is not saying. This is not saying that every country, or even most countries, are going to be at war all the time. That's not what it's saying. War and rumors of war means there's going to be constant international turmoil, constant tension between countries. But that doesn't mean we're always going to be in some kind of armed conflict. And by the way, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be more and more war as time goes on. That's a misreading of the passage. I read an article last week from Andrew Mack in the Washington Post. And he points out that though many people think that war and death toll is steadily climbing, it's actually doing the opposite. He says the reality is that since the end of the Cold War, armed conflict and nearly all other forms of political violence have decreased. The world is far more peaceful than it was. That's not to say it's going to stay that way. But he goes on to quote the Human Security Report that says since the early 1990s, there's been a sharp decline of worldwide war. And so we're not suggesting here there's always going to be war. We're not suggesting that there's not times of peace versus times of more conflict. What Jesus is saying is this: do not let international chaos confuse you. Don't let it lead you to the confusion that God has lost control. These kinds of things are terrible, but these kinds of things are all part of the plan of God. And when you pick up a newspaper and country A has invaded country B, and country C is upset about that, and country D is now developing some program to guard against all of this, don't let that lead you to the conclusion that God has lost control. This is all part of the plan of God. I've quoted before Donald Gray Barnhouse, a pastor from the last century. He was a pastor in Pennsylvania. And he was an international speaker for a good part of his ministry. There was one time when he had to go to Ireland to hold a bunch of meetings back when World War II started. And his family was in Normandy, France. He's going to pick up his family in France and then take them up to Ireland together. And when he arrived in France, he discovered that all the airports had been turned into military bases. He got in a plane. He got there by plane, but nobody's going to leave by airplane. And then he boarded a train to go to Ireland. And he said the scene was just intense. He said those bells were sounding because of the war, signaling men to military service. And Barnhouse witnessed men by the hundreds leaving their weeping wives and their weeping kids as they got on the train to fight the Germans. He said most would not return. The towns they went through would soon crumble because of the Allied forces' effort to liberate the country. He got on a steamer to head for England there when he got to the coast, and he met the captain. They were listening to the radio reports. And they heard that Chamberlain said that the war was about to come. The captain, in a very calm manner, said, "This is it. There's no turning back." The scene was just as intense when he got to London. Hundreds of children lined up in the streets, ready for evacuation. One child, Barnhouse said, summed up the picture. He had food smeared all over his face, perhaps his last meal for a while. His pants were wet. He's crying with misery and terror, and nothing could be done. Barnhouse made his way to Ireland, and one man said, "I hope you have a good sermon. It will be the last one that these men hear for a long time." And Barnhouse said he understood the gravity of the moment. He sat there in his hotel room praying for the right text, praying to give them a message that would encourage them at a difficult time. He said, "I prayed and I prayed, and I stood there and prayed longer, and suddenly the perfect text jumped out at me." The next morning, he made his way to St. Enoch, the largest church in Ireland at that time. It was almost 11 o'clock when Chamberlain would declare war on Germany. The minister of the church looked at him and said, "Thank God I don't have to preach. Church is full of lads that may never return. May God give you a good text this morning." Just before he got up to preach, an elder in the church slipped him a note saying that no reply from Hitler. Chamberlain has just declared war on Germany. World War II is on. What do you say to a group of men that are about to enter World War II with no hope of return? What kind of text could God possibly give you? Well, the text came right out of verse 6. "And you will hear of war and rumors of war. See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet." And he got up and said, "You will hear of war and rumor of war." But he would stop after describing the horrible scene that he saw on a train, and he would say, "Do not be alarmed. The bells will sound, mobilization will take place, do not be alarmed. Millions of homes will be broken up. Do not be alarmed. Children will be torn from their mothers. They will hear cries and wails that have been going up from all the world. Jesus said, do not be alarmed. The tension was mounting in the church. And Barnhouse stopped and said, these are either words of a madman or they are the words of God and we can trust them. Do not be alarmed. Men will die. Do not be alarmed. Children will cry. Do not be alarmed. How can Jesus say such things? Then Barnhouse said this, nothing has ever happened that has not flowed in the channel that God has not dug for it. What great words. Nothing has ever happened that has not flowed in the channel that God has not dug for it. What is Barnhouse saying? He's saying, your life is about to fall apart. Let's not sugarcoat it. Some of you are going to go off. Most of you will not return. Let's not sugarcoat it. But God has a plan. God has a plan. And God has a plan that is mapped out that shows us in the last days there's going to be difficult things that are going to take place. But you hold on and you endure spiritually. Why? Because in the end, Jesus is going to come and he's going to stamp out evil. Do not be discouraged or disillusioned. This is all part of the plan of God. You know, when we look to the gospel, friends, this is what we see. You look to the gospel and you see how God had a plan in the death of Jesus. And that's where we find our strength. We look out in the streets today, we see all kinds of evil, we see all kinds of violence. You pick up the USA Today and it makes you want to cringe because of some of the things you read. But then we look to the cross and we're reminded of this. If God can make sense of the horrible, bloody death of an innocent man on a cross, he can make sense of all the events that are taking place today. If God had a plan when an innocent man called the Son of God went to the cross, certainly God's got a plan for all the events taking place today. And if God can bring about the salvation of the world through the death of an innocent man, he can bring about glory and honor to himself through the war and the rumor of war and the famine and all that follows. Let's close with prayer. Thank you, Lord.